I didn't go there right away. I wasn't working for the Red Cross at that time, but we did have people respond within days of the disaster. And from everything I've heard, it was complete chaos in the aftermath of the disaster. We work with our partner organizations, national societies in the affected countries. So, for instance, the Indonesian Red Cross, go by the name of PMI, we're working there. And actually, a lot of the PMI volunteers were responsible for carrying bodies and disposing of bodies and that kind of thing. So I think it was a very grisly scene. When I went there in September and early October of last year, again, I saw progress on the ground, but I was also really touched by the people who I met there, their strength and resilience, facing this disaster and recovery every day, but also, heard a lot of stories of heartbreak and the struggle to get back on their feet.
Now, 8 countries were affected by the tsunami. What was the situation like differently in each country?
Yeah, we actually, it's interesting because different people have different accounts of how many countries. Sometimes you hear 8, sometimes we often say, some people say more than 12 countries were actually affected. And again, the range, it's a wide range from people, who lost everything, places like Banda Aceh in Indonesia, which was absolutely destroyed. Again, buildings were destroyed. Not only did they have to suffer from the waves and the effect of the tsunami, but also the earthquake. They were nearest the epicenter of the earthquake. In other areas, the damage was less extensive. But again, when you're talking about homes and you're talking about jobs and livelihoods, and you're talking about people being displaced from their loved ones and their family, there's a lot of devastation, a lot of work to be done to help people get back on their feet.
Have you been able to unite families so far?
We do some of that work. Actually, the Red Cross is known internationally for their family tracing. It's one of the things that we do both in the United States and internationally in conjunction with the International Red Cross based in Geneva, the ICRC. But we've actually just recently sent our family tracing delegate to Sri Lanka to help work with families and help reunite people. Which is one of the things that is very important after a disaster when people get separated. And there's some amazing technology out there that people are using to reconnect families.
I was just going to ask, what kind of process do you have to go through to relocate families? Or not relocate, to reunite, excuse me.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's again, it's an interesting thing. They sort of use both high-tech and low-tech approaches to try and get people's names, get lists together, and to try and disseminate those lists and find out where people are and if they're living in other camps or to find out what happened to people, if they've been lost or that kind of thing. Again, this one of the strengths of the Red Cross is that we have over 180 societies around the world. So we're able to work, and we work in communities just like we work here in local communities around the United States. These national societies are able to work on a real community level and to try and find and people and help them reunite if they've been separated.
Now, what other needs are we looking at that the tsunami impact brought?
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, definitely the big needs that people are still struggling with, definitely the housing issue, especially in Indonesia where people are still living in tents. That's one of the biggest ones. Livelihoods is another. Getting clean water to people, and that's one of our strengths, is actually water and sanitation, which is basically bringing clean water. A lot of the wells were either destroyed or got salt water in them, so people's access to clean water was greatly was made much harder to get clean water and safe water, as well as clean sanitation services. So the American Red Cross has been doing a lot of that. Another program that we're doing that we find has been very effective is our psychosocial programming, and this is sort of the equivalent of disaster mental health here in the United States. So it's working with people after a disaster to overcome the trauma that they experienced. Again, the emotional trauma of losing your house or losing a loved one is amazing and can be very devastating. So we're working on a community level to try and strengthen people and to empower communities to get stronger by encouraging people to express themselves through creative means, whether it's painting or singing or dancing or other community-based activities. So doing that to help them overcome the trauma that they experienced.
Before the tsunami happened, what was the area like? What were the, you know, what kind of social classes were the people? What was the country like? What did the people depend on?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, that would depend a little bit on which country you're talking about. But like in Indonesia, it's actually pretty interesting that that there was actually had been conflict there for many, many years, actually going back, I think, over 100 years of conflict between a separatist group there that go by the name of GAM, G-A-M. And after the tsunami struck, it actually sort of a silver lining effect was that it helped the this group come to peace terms with the government and with the Indonesian military. So that was one of the few sort of positive outcomes, but it was an interesting effect in this sort of area that has been so badly devastated. But at least the peace process has moved forward there, and I think that's one at least positive that we can take away from it. One of the things, just sort of on a different way that I noticed when I was there, is that the landscape has been completely changed in certain areas, and it's almost the absence of, it's what you don't see that's amazing, because these areas that were, palm trees, I mean, it's sort of this idyllic, I mean, Southeast Asia, a lot of people have been to Thailand or, Indonesia, it's just these beautiful paradise kind of setting, and in a lot of places where there used to be palm trees and that kind of thing, those trees have been all wiped out, homes have been wiped away, so it's these sort of open, vast open spaces that you see there that are really quite amazing to see and sort of saddening at the same time.
Now, those areas, a lot of the countries, they, depended a lot on tourism. How has that, do you know if that's changed at all?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Again, I think you have to go country by country. And again, in Indonesia, the area there, because of the conflict, was not a big tourist area. I know Sri Lanka is a country that does depend greatly on tourism. And I have heard that it has begun to rebound now, and tourists are coming back. There's a lot of tourists that come both from Europe as well as, it's very close to India, so there's a lot of Indian tourists who come back. It depends on the area, even within Sri Lanka. That's mostly on the west coast and the south coast where there's a lot of tourism that has revived. I know that I just was reading recently that in Thailand, that Phuket is the main island there that was damaged, and that their tourism is still way down. I guess people are still, fearful of going back to that area.
Has that really damaged the economy of the countries?
I would not be able to speak, specifically about how much it's damaged it, but I'm sure the impact has been pretty negative on countries that have experienced so much loss and devastation, and that depend on tourism. Obviously, is a big, get in that part of the world. I know Thailand and Phuket is a big tourist destination. Indonesia is the same way, so I'm sure that has had some negative impact. And the important thing now is to try and, one of the goals, I think, looking ahead is to try and get people back into their livelihood. So whether it's you're working in tourism or whether they're fishermen or fisheries and that kind of thing, we're working actually with the World Wildlife Fund to restore a bunch of fisheries and to try and do them in a way that's environmentally sound and that will be sustainable for the long term. So that's one of the things that we're looking at for now, looking ahead, 2006, is try get people back into their work. First you need to get them safe and healthy, and then you need to get them back into work and to try and have them, returning to their normal lifestyles and sort of things that we're trying to do.
Now, when the Red Cross got there, how did they assess the needs of the tsunami victims, and how do you continue to do so, prioritizing? How does that work?
Yeah, again, that's a great question, and it's a very complex process of evaluation, and it's one of the things that we have seen a lot of people talked about, the pace of recovery and questions about, the question people often ask me is, why is it going slowly? And one of my responses is that it's going slowly because you want to do it properly. And that involves doing careful assessments. It involves looking at the landscape and looking at things like, doing things environmentally correct and making sure that it's culturally correct. I mean, especially with an issue like housing, you can't just go in and build and throw up a bunch of houses and expect them to be sustainable for the long term. You have to really look at, where is the water and sanitation going to go? Where's, are they up to code? If there's another disaster, are people going to be safe? And these kinds of things. So these are areas in the American Red Cross, and as well as what we call the movement, it's the International Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies around the world. We've been doing this for over 125 years. So we have a real expertise in terms of understanding how to do things in a way that hopefully is going to be sustainable and is done correctly and thoroughly and not just doing things quickly. But there are many issues that come up, and it's really important to do proper assessments before you begin the work. I think that's one of the the sort of lessons learned of this disaster as well as other ones.
What kind of cultural barriers has the American Red Cross faced while down there so far?
Sure, we've faced too many barriers. I mean, I think the American Red Cross, again, because we can work with the societies in the affected countries, so that we work with the Indonesian Red Cross or the Sri Lankan Red Cross. In a lot of ways, it's been, I think, interesting for people of different cultures to come together. Obviously, the area in Banda Aceh, as I'm sure you know, is mostly a Muslim area. So that's been a real interesting thing. I know that a lot of public opinion polls have actually shown that America has gotten a slightly better people's view of America has improved based on the work of the tsunami. But the important thing, I think, as any agency, you know, international agency, is to just come in and sort of do things, you know, make things your way. You have to look at the culture. You have to work on the local level, work with the communities and local communities, and make sure that they have their input to how you're doing things. So, like, one of the things that we do in the water and sanitation is we're not just putting in new water systems, but we work with and to train the local communities so that they can be so that they can understand how the water systems work and they can figure out where the best place for their water would be and that kind of thing, and that they can then take over and really try and build up the capacity of local communities to have their own, to run their own water systems or whatever the project is. But we want to make sure that we're working with the communities and not coming out as an outsider and just imposing our sort of will upon them. So that's a sensitive issue, but I think again, a lot of, I think, lessons are going to be learned in sort of how to do things. But so far, the American Red Cross, I think, has been quite successful at working with the local communities, and really cooperating has been a real positive of this experience.
Okay. With all the relief and the reconstruction going on, have the donations so far been enough for reconstruction?
Well, as you probably know, the response to the tsunami was just amazing. For the American Red Cross, we've actually raised over $570 million to date. So it's just an amazing outpouring of generosity from Americans, and it's everybody from school children to corporations, you know, college students, I'm sure, as well. We're giving money at that time. It was right after the holidays, and it was on TV, and I think everybody was moved by what they saw overseas. So we actually raised, we think that we've raised enough money that to cover our programs. And a lot of disasters, a lot of international disasters, the problem is that you're underfunded. The problem is that the response, for one reason or another, you know, people don't give quite enough for really the relief effort that's required. And in this case, we're actually, you know, the American Red Cross, like many organizations, actually has enough money to do long-term recovery programming. So not only were we able to come in and meet a lot of the emergency needs, like water and health issues and stuff like that, but we're able to do this long-term recovery where we're helping to really build infrastructure and to do some of the psychosocial programming, again, dealing with emotional issues. That has to be a long-term a long-term process to help people really recover. So I think the outpouring of donations has enabled us to do some work that maybe we wouldn't have normally been able to do.
Has the Red Cross taken up relief projects this size before, and how long has that taken?
When the tsunami struck, I know that this has been the largest. It was the largest outpouring of donations for any one disaster. Of course, since then Katrina struck, and that is actually, you know, the Red Cross received more money for Katrina than it did for the tsunami. But for an international disaster, it was the largest one. But the Red Cross does have a lot of experience. They've worked in different hurricanes around both, you know, largely in our hemisphere. You know, Hurricane Mitch was one of the big ones that people talk about going back a few years, as well as earthquakes like the Gujarat earthquake, or there was an earthquake in Turkey a few years ago and one in Armenia. So we've actually have a lot of experience working in international relief and recovery, but this is certainly one of the biggest ones. And, you know, our plan is a five-year plan, and we've just finished the first year. And as I said, I think, you know, things are starting to get better, but we're there for the long term, and we're committed to this at least 5 years of being there and trying to help, you know, so many people who were devastated by this, and trying to help them get back on their feet and get back to sort of their normal lifestyle and make sure that they are hopeful for their future, because there's a lot of work to be done.
Have the South Asian governments in the different countries that the American Red Cross have been, have they been cooperative with working with the Red Cross?
I think overall I'd say they have been cooperative. We do work in countries on the invitation, both of the Red Cross or Red Crescent Society in that country, and as well as the government of that country. So we're invited in. We don't work in countries where we are not invited in. That's part of the Red Cross policy and system of working. Indonesia, in particular, I think has been, you know, that we've been able to work closely both with the PMI, as I mentioned, the Indonesian Red Cross, and as well as the government, who have developed their, it's called BRR, which is the Reconstruction Organizing Committee for the government, and has really helped with so many different agencies responding, has helped to coordinate the activities. At the same time, all the governments, like the people in the countries, were, you know, very severely hampered by this disaster, and I think everybody struggled at first to get, you know, to figure out how to work and how to take on a project of this scale. Again, like we see now in Katrina, that there's so many people, you know, that it's taken our government a long time to figure out, and, you know, we're still figuring out how to respond appropriately to this, to the disaster like Katrina. Well, the same thing was true in the tsunami, where it was just a big, where it was such a massive disaster, and so the government did take a while, and coordination was an issue, but I think things are getting better, and again, we work closely with the government and with our national societies as best we can.
What kind of political differences have come up while working in countries like Indonesia or Sri Lanka?
Yeah, well, one of the interesting things, as I mentioned before, is that things have sort of gotten better in Indonesia as far as the political and this rebel movement that was going on in and around Banda Aceh and Aceh province. Unfortunately, we see actually a difference in Sri Lanka, is that they've also had civil conflict going back many years that, you know, crosses sort of ethnic and social lines and that kind of thing, and that's actually deteriorated, and you know, we're quite concerned about that. The American Red Cross doesn't get involved in conflicts of that sort. We're American Red Cross is committed to neutrality when it comes to conflict. It's part of our mandate and our sort of fundamental principles. But it is a concern that, and I'm sure people are looking at why the situation is getting worse in Sri Lanka, where we saw things get better in Indonesia. And hopefully things will not deteriorate too far, because it does obviously hamper the recovery effort that's ongoing in Sri Lanka. A lot of the areas there still need a lot of help and assistance to improve the situation.
Great. Well, we are nearing the end, so one last question. Now, because the tsunami isn't getting as much media coverage as it did before, how are you doing in terms of people volunteering to go down to the tsunami, you know, or even just more funding for the tsunami? Has that been an issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we did see a return their attention after, you know, around the one-year anniversary. And one of our goals for this year is actually to remind people and keep people's attention on the efforts that are going on there. We have people overseas, over 40 people from the American Red Cross, and, you know, hundreds of others, Americans and people from all around the world, are working in these communities, and they'll be there for a long time. And the conditions that they're working in are quite difficult. So, you know, we're committed to a long-term recovery. Again, as I said, the American Red Cross has raised enough money for the tsunami, although there are other disasters out there that do need funding. Pakistan comes to mind. There are other ones, and obviously, if people are interested, I'd encourage them to visit our website at, you know, www.redcross.org and see how they can help, because there's always help that's needed, especially when it comes to international disasters.
Great. Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us on the show tonight and giving your insight on tsunami relief.
Sure. I appreciate the time, and I appreciate talking about these issues. I think they're very important. So I'm glad that I got this opportunity to talk with you.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Have a good night.
Good night.
Thank you, Janet. That's it for this week's Earshot. Tune in next week as we discuss the growth of plagiarism and its quiet expansion from the classroom to the American workplace. Once again, for Earshot, I'm Mike Arroyo.
And I'm Dee Harvey. Earshot is produced by Dee Harvey and Mike Arroyo. Now stay tuned for John and Shake 'Em On Down.